high culture meets high technology at the bleeding edge of the radical right. Majority Rights Radio.
Hello and welcome to MR Radio. I'm GW and it's the 2nd of December, somewhat past, it's 2014, there we are, in England. But it's 2014 plus 2 hours in South Africa, where my guest, the author, journalist and activist, Dr. Dan Root, is online. Good evening, Dan. Welcome to MR Radio.
Good evening, David.
Okay, fine. Now, I wanted to start really by just asking you about your background and how you got into your current occupation. I know you're a few years younger than me, a few very valuable years younger than me, but you seem to have been working and writing about the rights of Afrikaners for pretty well as long as I can remember. When did you actually start?
Well, I think I started doing it more really seriously about 12 to 13 years ago, although when I was very young, around 20, I published two or three little books which were not really political. They were more literary, but they did contain some political elements. But at the time, I was in a more sort of liberal to left-wing mode when I was at university, and I went to a very left-wing university, the University of Witwatersrand. And then I went overseas for about 6 or 7 years, where I lived in Paris mostly. And then, you know, I developed a more mature view of the world and, you know, started really seeing our country in perspective as well. Because, you know, when you grow up here, sometimes you get the impression that, you know, we're just a backwater and things are so much better in the Northern Hemisphere, especially in Europe. But you do realize after a time that there are some things that might be more developed, say, in Europe or in the UK or in North America. Yeah. But in other respects, you know, we have a remarkable country here. You know, we by no means a third world country. We are the only industrialized country in Africa, but of course, you know, we've got severe problems with ethnic coexistence and culture, you know, what the very famous American political writer from Harvard, Samuel Huntington, called the clash of civilizations. You know, we really are living through a clash of civilizations, or have been for 350 years, but it's now, of course, become a very intense thing, and it's really threatening at least the existence of white people in South Africa in a very good way.
Okay, Dan, I'm interested to know what your impression was while you were in Paris as a student. It would have been in what, mid-70s, I suppose, or 77 or so?
I was in Paris around, you know, I did some postgraduate studies there from about 85 to 92.
Oh, really? Right, as late as that?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Well, still the same question. You would have been well aware of the huge amount of heat that was under, you know, the just cause of the ANC. Everybody here was supposed to hold to an opinion, as you'd be well aware, that was extremely damning of the Nationalist Party and the Afrikaners. And it must have been quite a shock for you to get out and actually find that in the sort of intellectual circles that you were likely moving in.
Yes, that's true, although I would say it was less pronounced in France. You know, people in France don't know that much about South Africa, but of course, at the time, the British anti-apartheid movement, Trevor Huddleston in particular, they had a huge campaign against South Africa going, you know, I think around about 87 you had those huge concerts where some of the British rock artists used to sing Free Mandela and so on. And some of that did cross over into France. But what struck me at the time as well was that the whole anti-apartheid thing in France was really almost run out of the headquarters of the French Communist Party, or the PCF. And they used to have, and the Jeunesse Communiste used to have a monthly protest in front of the South African embassy. But, of course, there were lots of critical articles in Le Monde and other left-of-center newspapers in France about South Africa, and very positive publicity given to people like Winnie Mandela Desmond Tutu and other black activists in South Africa. But curiously, at the time, I didn't really quite realize what was going on. I mean, of course, I did appreciate the whole campaign, and it eventually started questioning the whole thing, because there were so many stereotypes about South Africa at the time that even though I was myself critical of the old government, I just couldn't associate myself with the level of propaganda that was being poured out against South Africa at the time. And also the notion that eventually, the blacks would just overthrow the government and the army and the police. I mean, coming from here, I knew that they didn't have the wherewithal or the means to do that, or the organizational capacity. If you looked at the old system and the army and the police that we used to have, it was just impossible for a sort of a third-rate guerrilla come terrorist movement like the ANC to simply overthrow the government. Yeah, and people overseas were very naive about that. But of course, then the surprising thing happened in that the old National Party they just gave up and they did an about turn. In fact, we could talk about it a bit during this program. One of the people who reported on the negotiations in the early 90s, he was a journalist, also a sort of a renegade Afrikaner who was at the time quite liberal, but who gradually, under the new regime, became more and more disillusioned and critical, has unfortunately just committed suicide, and that was all over the newspapers today and yesterday. But his book that he wrote about, he wrote a book in Afrikaans, which he translate as Britman, is sort of an expression for fellow, and the swan song of the enlightened Afrikaners. In that book, he describes the naivety with which the old government approached the negotiations and how they actually stabbed their own supporters in the back by eventually just surrendering to the ANC. And especially the chief negotiator of the National Party, he was then the Minister of Constitutional Development, Ruth Meyer, at a critical moment in 1992, he just completely caved into ANC demands, and that led to the new constitution, which was promulgated in 1996, which is supposedly a very liberal and enlightened constitution, but each and every right in our constitution is qualified by race. And effectively, white people in this country have been constitutionally classed as second-class citizens, because it doesn't matter whether it's the right to property or the right to economic activity or education or language, culture, everything is qualified in terms of some form of affirmative action, what they call transformation here.
Transformation, I've seen that word, yes.
Yes, it gets bandied about a lot. It's quite ironic, really, because in the past, when I was still a student and the Communist Party was banned in South Africa, transformation was a euphemism for revolution. You couldn't quite openly preach revolution without getting noticed by the authorities and by the much-feared security police that we used to have at that time. They were far less ferocious than the criminals that we have these days. But then people started using this term transformation as a euphemism for revolution. And after 1994, it became a kind of synonym for the radical form of affirmative action that the South African government applies in South Africa. And that will never end. I mean, there have been debates about whether it should have a sunset clause or whether black people born under this new government and growing up in homes where they have rich parents who benefit from the so-called black economic empowerment transactions, all of these affirmative action transactions on the stock exchange where black people get almost free shares in companies and they become rich overnight. I mean, some of them become billionaires in rand terms overnight. And even the child of such a wealthy millionaire black person would still qualify for affirmative action over a white child born, say, in a very poor area and struggling to survive. So
obviously the situation you're describing is perpetual disadvantage of white skin is well known.
Yes.
In some parts of the world, and as you're right, it will never go away, because it's assumed that racism attaches automatically to white skin. It is a condition we have to be educated out of. Is that something that has been institutionalized in law? And
oh yes, definitely.
Yeah.
I, apart from our action group called PRAG, P-R-A-A-G, we've also got an English website called prague.co.uk.
I'll put up links on the post to that.
Okay, fine, great. I'm also a member of the Freedom Front political party in South Africa. I joined up a few months ago because I'm interested in getting involved in the local elections in 2011 in the Pretoria area. And we've got a committee there that's supposed to be investigating all of this legislation and actually drawing up a list of all the various laws putting whites at a disadvantage. And just off the top of my head, I would say there are at least 20 laws in South Africa to do with economic activity, especially where whites are disadvantaged vis-a-vis blacks. And, but there are other laws as well to do with, when it comes to employment, there's a so-called employment equity law. They have all these Orwellian names, but they are merely intended to, put whites at a disadvantage when they apply for posts in companies, and whites get overlooked for promotion. Just this afternoon, I had a phone call from a friend who works for a very large insurance company in Victoria, and he told me he's actually a lawyer, an in-house lawyer at this insurance company, and he's been looking for 2 years to appoint someone to work under him in the legal department, and he's just not allowed to employ a white person. And we recently conducted a series of interviews, and the three people who were the best qualified in terms of both experience and qualifications, degrees, and so on, were three white women. But he couldn't appoint them, because inside every large company, there's a so-called transformation committee. And each and every appointment has to be vetted by the transformation committee, which is composed normally of black people, and they simply look at the race of the appointments, and then they veto systematically all white appointments and send them back and say that the person concerned just has to look harder for black talent. But, in the normal course of things, even in South Africa, where we've got 40 million black people, black talent is normally hard to find. There was an article in the newspaper the other day which stated that half of all graduates at university in South Africa are still white. And then if you look at certain sectors of education like engineering and mathematical sciences, accounting, the majority of graduates are still white. For example, in accounting, we've got, I don't know if in Britain we use the same term, chartered accountant.
Yes.
We've got about 27 chartered accountants in South Africa, and our accounting is of a very high standard and recognized worldwide. And 25,000 out of the 27,000 are white. And then you've got about 1,000 Indians, and only 1,000 are black. And the blacks are at school and university. They do have certain, they are really advantaged, and, they've got all sorts of benefits that accrue to them, including in the final school leaving exam. In mathematics, they get a 5% bonus added onto their marks so that they can as a supposedly because they were disadvantaged in the past, you know.
Yep.
But they get an added bonus to make sure that they can compete, you know, with white children.
Just looking at this situation a bit further back again, if we can, when the Great Change happened, I remember it well. It's one of those events that lots of people, you know, they know where they were when they heard the news, this sort of thing. And I remember seeing Mandela being released from Robben Island and this tremendous hoo-ha that was on the BBC, lasted the whole day. I remember watching Desmond Tutu, who was being interviewed, so excited he was unable to prevent himself from dancing in front of the camera, which wasn't entirely what the interviewer was expecting. But one puts it down to exuberance, you know, which is diverse and exciting, and we all need much more of it. So there's obviously an enormous amount of goodwill and an enormous amount of expectation in the world at large. What about the Afrikaners? I mean, they'd seen this situation happen. It must have come as quite a shock. What did they expect of the Rainbow Nation?
Yes. Well, you know, there has been a little bit of a debate around that. But even though, you know, in that 1992 referendum where white people in South Africa voted for a black majority government, the vote was really carried by the 40% of English-speaking whites. They voted something like 85% in favor of that, whereas the Afrikaner vote was split right down the middle, 50-50.
Right.
You know, and I'm not really proud of it because I actually at the time voted yes as well, because everybody just got swept up in this media frenzy, and if you had to vote against this great event, you know, you were really a few degrees short of Satan. And also the no vote didn't have any funding. All the big companies, corporations supported the yes vote. The mainstream media supported the yes vote, and so on. And but as time went by, even the people who voted yes, like myself at the time, to my horror, you know, we realized that we'd actually been duped, as it were, because, you know, we were promised a society that was that would be run along liberal democratic principles, where there would be equality and a sort of a democratic ethos. But instead, we got an even more ethnically divided society, a very hypocritical society where, you know, there's equality on paper, but in practice, there's severe inequality and injustice. And of course, many people think that we're descending into barbarism with the amount of violence that we have, and also the collapse of our infrastructure. You know, in the big cities like Johannesburg, Pretoria, Cape Town, and Durban, you don't notice it that much. But when you go out to the countryside, in smaller towns and so on, you know, there the roads are just full of holes. People don't have clean drinking water anymore. They're constant, and the municipalities are simply looted by these local black town councillors, and they end up being bankrupt and not even able to you know, remove the rubbish anymore or provide clean water. So, yeah, you know, it's been a process of constant disillusionment as we've gone along. And I would say that South Africa is, under the surface, more polarized now than at any stage in its history, because the whole movement in the 1980s was really driven from overseas. And was funded from overseas.
Do you see it as being... Oh, sorry, okay, the funding...